You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, there's a lot going on that I want to get into. The top hedge fund managers made $21 billion last year. This is 25 people. Loan funds for the first time in, 2 years now? 3 years? Have, for 2 weeks in a row, seen a reversal of funds. We'll get into that. This is kind of arcane financial stuff. But what it says to me is we're on the edge of something really big and really bad. And meanwhile, the Supreme Court, was it Monday? Was it yesterday or was it last? Yeah, it was Monday. The Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor was the last conservative on the Supreme Court who was very concerned about government sanctioning public prayer. In part for the same reason that Madison was. He was concerned that Madison, who was a Christian, was concerned that any one particular denomination might end up in charge. And so she was a reliable vote against things like allowing public prayer. She is replaced by Sam Alito on the court, and he has changed that vote. And in fact, a lot of people have been wondering why it took so long. This, of course, is absolutely inconsistent with the position of people like Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin, who in his autobiography said rather famously, I have found Christian dogma unintelligible early in life. I absented myself from Christian assemblies. And Jefferson was even more emphatic in a variety of times and places. But it's interesting to see how this has played out. And Bishop Council Ned is with us. He's a founding member of Project 21. He's the rector of the St. Albans Anglican Church in Pine Grove Mills, Pennsylvania. And Bishop Ned, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
It's interesting that you're Anglican. James Madison, the father of our Constitution,
yes,
his first veto as President of the United States was for a piece of legislation throughout the Washington and Adams administration. We had welfare programs in the United States here. In Washington, D.C., we had poorhouses that paid for the food, housing, and clothing and medical care of poor people. And Congress passed a law in the first year of the Madison administration that routed that money through a local Anglican church. And there was a big hullabaloo because it went through a local Presbyterian church, and there was an Anglican church that was protesting it. And Madison vetoed it, saying that it established that no federal money should go to any churches whatsoever because it established a precedent, he said, for the state sanctioning religion.
Right.
I understand that you think. Well, first of all, what are your thoughts on the Supreme Court decision?
Well, I think it was a good decision. I think it was a fair and just decision. You know, the fact of the matter is, since Europeans, Westerners landed on this continent, they've been having prayer before meetings. You know, the Lost Colony. You know, they had meetings here in 1609. The very first thing they did was celebrated Mass, and then they had their meeting to sort of organize the colony.
Well, they also had slaves. I mean, are you saying because something was done in 1609, we should do it now?
No, I'm saying because something's edifying and is good for the overall group, they should continue to do it.
Okay. So, for example, this is Thomas Jefferson in 1814. He wrote a letter to Dr. Thomas Cooper. He says, finally, in answer to Fortescue Allon's question why the Ten Commandments should not now be considered a part of the common law of England or of America, we may say that they are not because they never were. Christianity was not introduced till the 7th century, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place in the year 598, and out of the last 686. Here, then, was a space of 200 years during which the common law was in existence and Christianity no part of it. We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is part of the common law as that the Christian religion is. In truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy and even bolder than they are. End of quote. Why should my tax dollars be paying for me to be preached at, particularly if it's a religion that I don't agree with?
So your argument is that just because you disagree with something that your tax dollar shouldn't go towards it?
No.
Get that caveat?
Well, that's an interesting question. No,
well,
my argument is...
the government pays for that I shouldn't have, that I don't want to pay for.
No, excellent point. Well made. You're absolutely right. That's the weakest argument I could possibly make. No, the argument that I would make is that the First Amendment to the Constitution says that we shall have no official state religion. That the government shall not endorse religion.
And the government's not endorsing religion by allowing an elected body, a group of people given authority. And, you know, again, I argue, and the Constitution argues, that authority comes from our Creator. So if you're going to take a moment...
You're thinking of the Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
The Constitution does not say that authority comes from our Creator.
The Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, the Declaration of Independence is not a legal document.
Neither of the litany of documents that you've just cited from Thomas Jefferson, but...
You're right. But if you want to talk about the law says that the government shall not sanction religion. And Jefferson, you read Jefferson and Madison's letters about this, and it's fascinating.
Religion and praying.
Jefferson was so concerned that religious people would end up getting political power and it would corrupt politics. Madison, who was a Christian, Madison was far more concerned that his Christian church would be corrupted by, you know, money coming from government.
And then what's happened? The exact opposite of that.
I think we've seen both.
With animosity towards faith seem to be driving the agenda now, and I don't know that that's appropriate.
Well, I have no personal animosity toward faith. I call myself a Christian. My concern is that if we are going to say that we're going to use our tax dollars to open public meetings with prayers, what happens when the Church of Satan worshipers, who flip the stars upside down on the GOP's logo, when they decide that they want to come in and have us all worship Satan? I mean, wouldn't you feel uncomfortable sitting in the back of the room listening to a prayer to Lucifer?
Well, I certainly would, and I'd have something to say about it, just as these people had something to say about it. And the fact is, in the Greece, New York case, the Greece Town Council or whatever let the Wiccans come in and actually lead opening prayers before one of their meetings.
Well, Wiccans are not Satan worshipers. I'm taking it a step way beyond Wiccans.
Well, like I said, I have a right to say something about that, but that doesn't mean that it's not a health...
So you think that the First Amendment says that you do not have a right to be free of having Satan worshiping inflicted upon you in a government-sponsored way?
I don't like Satan worshiping. I think it's fundamentally a flawed religion and a waste of time.
The Bible says that Lucifer was an angel. I mean, he's part of the Godhead, right?
But I certainly don't think that it's appropriate, and I'm going to have something to say about it. But the fact is, I mean, I think this was a big step forward and a huge acknowledgement.
A big step forward for what?
For people of faith who think this is perfectly appropriate to open public meetings with prayer, the way it's been done on this continent for 300 years.
Well, public meetings and government meetings could be very different things.
Well, they could be.
This is...
But, you know, Congress opens with prayer. Tons of, you know, probably literally thousands of town councils around this country open with prayer.
Right.
And it's been the tradition of this country for a very long time.
Right, and that was the basis of the Supreme Court decision. And I understand the logic. It just seems like at some point, well, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting when the Satan worshipers start showing up, you know, and saying, what about us? And let's all pray to Lucifer.
I'm happy to have that debate with them.
Yeah. Well, it won't be a debate. You'll have to sit in the back of the room and listen, because the Supreme Court has said that, you know, that's the way it is. But anyhow, Bishop Counsel Ned, pleasure meeting you and talking with you.
Pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Founding member of Project 21 and the website nationalcenter.org, p21index.html. Thank you. Here we go.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nate Sweet, producer with The Big Picture and international media superstar. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
How's it going, Tom?
Good. So tonight, climate change. Actually, you're going to be an international media superstar tonight.
I will. Indeed. I'm adding to my stardom.
Okay. Cool. We're going to another 35 Twitter followers or another 35,000. We'll see. Climate change study, the U.S. government released a climate change study today.
Yeah, it is the third national climate assessment in total. Congress actually mandated that the White House or government release these reports every 4 years back in 1990, but the Clinton and Bush administration sort of dragged their feet about that, the Bush administration especially. No report was issued during the Bush administration. So this is the Obama administration's report, and the conclusions are pretty damning. You know, they come out and say that climate change is happening, it's real. The evidence, you can see it with the increased drought, you can see it in increased temperatures, you can see it in the increase in extreme weather events. You know, it doesn't take a lot of the things that everybody has been saying for the past few years as, you know, as hints that climate change is happening are actually proof that climate change is happening. Right. And then it also says that things are going to get a lot worse unless we start doing something pretty soon.
Well, and in fact, things are going to get a lot worse even if we do something soon. I mean, they're talking 71% increase in precipitation. This is, you know, one of the things that they're pointing out is
that that's just for the Northeast.
Yeah, just
specifically,
you know,
hard.
That one of the things that they're pointing out is that it's not necessarily you're going to get more water. It's that you're going to get more water over a shorter period of time. You're going to have
more extreme events.
Yeah, extreme, exactly.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's very important about this report is, at least from my perspective, it clarifies a lot of the misconceptions people have, because they'll say, oh, well, it's not getting much warmer for me in the Southeast. I live in Georgia. This report says, yeah, that's consistent with a lot of the events, a lot of the, you know, the trends we've been seeing over the past few years. So
right.
I think it clarifies that for the public mind, which is definitely a good thing. But we will be talking with Brenda Urquhart and Michael Dorsey about that report, breaking down some of the stuff that's in there.
Yeah. And you know, essentially what this thing is saying is that by the end of the century, and I won't be around to see that, but if I ever have grandchildren, they certainly will be, and you may be, who knows, that by the end of the century, basically the entire United States is going to have a climate like Phoenix, Arizona right now.
Yeah. And what's particularly shocking is even in the more it is still conservative estimates that they're proposing for what the likelihood of what's going to be like.
Yeah, this doesn't even get into stuff like what happens if the methane melts
right.
in the Arctic.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Okay, from there we're going to go to our politics panel, and it will be you and George Cole, and who else am I missing?
We'll be talking about
Pasquale,
when Michael Bastash and me are going to be on the politics panel.
Okay.
We're going to be talking about the climate report. We'll be talking about new evidence that RomneyCare is working in Massachusetts, in ways that a lot of people didn't know that, you know, there's a new study that came out that showed that RomneyCare in Massachusetts has actually led to a decline in the death rate, which is a pretty shocking development. There's no study that's ever shown this before, so it's pretty significant.
In other words, RomneyCare saves lives,
exactly.
And Obamacare is basically RomneyCare on steroids.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. So it's a pretty good sign. The one thing that's making people a little bit skeptical of this, and, you know, Massachusetts is a very wealthy state with more doctors per capita, but it does show that if the state puts that much, or the government, any public entity puts that much investment into healthcare, it's going to turn out well. And we'll be talking about a whole lot of other stuff on the show as well.
There you go. So be sure to tune in tonight at 7 o'clock. Nate Sweet, great talking with you, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
I'll see you tonight. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. This is pretty amazing. David Tepper took home $3.5 billion last year. Now you would think, wow, this guy must have saved a lot of people's lives, right? He must be like the world's greatest brain surgeon. No, he's not. He's a hedge fund manager. $3.5 billion in 1 year. Number two is Stephen Cohen. He took home $2.4 billion, and he paid a $1.8 billion fine for breaking the law. An insider trading case, $1.8 billion fine. Martha Stewart goes to jail. He pays a fine. And then he takes $2.4 billion home. Third, John Paulson. How did John Paulson make his billions? Betting against the housing market. When the market burst in 2007, Paulson was ready for it, and he made a fortune. Last year, he made $2.3 billion. Simple question. What can anybody do on Earth? What can anybody do that we as a society can sanction they're taking $2 billion out of our economy for? This is, if there's ever been an argument for confiscatory, that is, confiscatory progressive taxes, that is, a tax where at the top levels the tax is so high that it essentially takes everything you make, this is it. You know, our best and brightest brains are going to go to college to try to become hedge fund managers instead of to you know, fix the world. This is insane. Meanwhile, these are from the Financial Times today. That was by Miles Johnson, the hedge fund correspondent for the Financial Times. Tracy Alloway and Vivian Rodriguez in New York are writing in the Financial Times, 95 consecutive weeks of inflows to U.S. funds that invest in leveraged loans made by banks. Okay, now here's the thing. You may invest, you know, banks make money on loans. And they make a lot of money on leveraged loans. A leveraged loan is not just the loan, but it's loans on loans and bets on loans. And all. So anyway. And you can buy, these are exchange-traded funds, these ETFs. You can buy basically a fund which is a collection of these leveraged loans by these banks. One of the ones that they talk about is the PowerShare Senior Loan Portfolio. It's gone up to $7.4 billion worth of assets in the space of 3 years. It's an exchange-traded fund. But here's where it gets spooky. This is, those of you who've been listening to this program for a long time will remember in the fall, as I recall, it might have been the spring, it was either the first or third quarter of 2007, and there was an article in the Financial Times about how the housing starts in the United States had dropped a little over 34%. And I came on the air and just, you know, read this small story, like I'm reading this small story to you right now, and I said, you know, the last time this happened was 1927. Late 1927, housing starts in the United States started falling. They continued to fall through 28, and it led right to the stock market crash of 29. Now, back then, information traveled a lot more slowly. And so, in 2007, I said, I think it might be a good time, if one were in the stock market, to get out of it. In fact, to get out of pretty much everything. Now, I'm not an investment advisor, and I'm not offering investment advice. I'm just saying. Let me read you the first two sentences of this article in today's Financial Times. 95 consecutive weeks of inflows to U.S. funds that invest in leveraged loans made by banks came to an abrupt halt in the second week of April when investors pulled $249 million from the market. Since then, investors have continued to withdraw money from the funds, taking out $664 million just last week, according to Lipper data. Now the worry is that these funds may not be able to handle billions of dollars worth of outflows without depressing loan prices and disrupting the wider market. Now, in 2007, the bubble that we had was the housing bubble, the phony baloney mortgage bubble. Right now, the bubble that we have is a credit bubble. We've had Stephanie Kelton, we've had a number of the economists on this program talking about there's over $50 trillion in private debt. The problem is not the government debt. Government debt, no big deal. The problem is private debt. And the fact that banks now are securitizing private debt in ways that make what they were doing with mortgages look creative. Mortgages are arguably a form of private debt, but this goes way beyond that. So we went through the dot-com bubble. So this is what happens when the top tax rate goes below 50%, is you get bubbles and busts. So we went through the tech bubble, the dot-com bubble during the Clinton administration, and then that crashed. And then we went through the housing bubble in the Bush administration, and then that crashed. And for the last 5 years, we've been in a credit bubble. And what has been happening is you've even seen companies, because interest rates are so low, companies are stashing hundreds of billions of dollars offshore and then borrowing domestically to fund their operations.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The net-net of all this is that it wouldn't surprise me if the crash of 2016 I was predicting in the title of my book of the same title were to happen before November of 2014. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Today in Seattle, by the way, for our listeners in Seattle, today is it's called Give Big Day, and it's because a foundation in Seattle, is called the Seattle Foundation, is doing a one-day fundraiser, and if you give to any nonprofit, they will match the gift if you live in Seattle. So for our Seattle listeners who are listening on KBCS, if you are interested in making a donation, you can go to kbcs.fm. Or give them a call at 425-564-5000, just as an FYI. WBAI, our New York affiliate, is also on a fundraising drive right now. And so we'll talk about that in the third hour. So anyhow, I wanted to mention those financial things. I want to get back to here's an interesting question that I would like to ask you. I want to get back also to this whole religion thing. I'm frankly very concerned. I initially, when the Supreme Court came out and said, "Ah, it's just tradition," you know, the Senate opens with a prayer. What's the big deal? My first response was, "Yeah, you know, what's the big deal?" But once you start breaking down the lines, you know, it's the old get the camel's nose into the edge of the tent metaphor. I'm concerned that. And in fact, I think, frankly, we passed this way back during the Bush Sr. administration, when Bush Jr. negotiated deals. Actually, it was during Reagan's second term, and Bush Jr. was the liaison between his daddy's upcoming presidential campaign and the fundamentalist Christian community. And they started doing these faith-based initiatives that became George Bush Sr.'s 1,000 Points of Light, where it's like, basically, let's give government money to religious groups. And Jerry Falwell was there with his hands out, and he became a multimillionaire in the process, and Pat Robertson is now a billionaire. And, I mean, you've got all these religious guys who got really, really rich off this, and a lot of it was government money, and continues to be. And now we're giving money to religious schools, to give religious indoctrination and education to kids. And it's going on and on and on, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And Bill Clinton continued it, by the way. And in fact, expanded the program. Because, hey, you know, votes. And then George W. Bush put it on super steroids. And Obama has inherited it and hasn't done anything to stop it. And so I think that we have a problem here in this country. And like I started to say in my discussion with the bishop, Jefferson was constantly worried that the priests were going to get inside the government. In fact, I've told this story before, but it is so worth repeating. I live about a 20-minute walk from the Jefferson Memorial. Louise and I live in a boat, a little cabin, you know, 1986 Chris Craft cabin cruiser on the Washington Channel. In the Washington Channel, dead ends into this pond in front of this pool in front of the Jefferson Memorial. And so on a nice weekend day, Louise and I will just walk down there because it's the Jefferson Memorial, you know. And if you ever, you know, ever make it to D.C., it's really worth going to see. And there's this little circular saying of Jefferson etched into the dome above this giant 15-foot statue of Thomas Jefferson in the middle of the memorial. And it says, hang on just a second, wrong page. It says, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man." That's all it says. Now, you would think, you know, and it's obviously a quote from Jefferson, and you would think that basically what he's saying is, I'm a Bible-thumping Christian, and I've sworn on the altar of God hostility against anything that's going to be a tyranny over the minds of men. Context is everything, my friends. Let me read you the actual letter from which that quote comes. This was in 1800. Thomas Jefferson was Vice President of the United States. He was challenging John Adams to become president. Adams wanted to run for a second term. Jefferson ran against him. He was Vice President. Jefferson beat him. There's a book coming out this fall called The Revolution of 1800 by Dan Sisson, and with a little help from me, but mostly Dan Sisson. He's a brilliant historian. You're going to love this book. We will be talking about it a lot this fall. And The Revolution of 1800 was the election of Thomas Jefferson. So here is this. And so Ben Rush was a good friend of Jefferson's. He was a doctor. Physician, and he was a deist. He was not a Christian. He was a deist. He believed that, you know, something, some incredible intelligence started it all and established the laws of nature, and it, nature had just been rolling along ever since then. And so Jefferson, a couple of months before the election, just 2 months before the election of 1800, so that would be like September of 1800, writes this note, this letter to Ben Rush, and in it he asks him, don't let anybody see this letter. This letter didn't come out until Jefferson was dead. And here it is. Remember the quote that's at the top of the Jefferson Memorial. I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man. Okay, that's the quote. Here is the letter. Dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus Irritabile Vetum, which is Latin for the species of angry priests, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, he's talking here about the First Amendment. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own form, the one true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. And then he turns to his being elected. He refers to that as the returning good sense of our country, if he gets elected. Because he referred to John Adams' presidency as the time of witches, you'll recall. Anyhow, he says, the returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes, the priests. And the preachers believe that any portion of power confided in me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, and enough, too, in their opinion. End of quote. The context rather changes the quote, does it not? I can't tell you how many right-wingers have come on this program. Oh, yeah, America was a Christian nation. Jefferson was a Christian. He said he swore on the altar of God hostility against the tyranny over the mind. The tyranny he was talking about was religion. He went on. This was in his autobiography. Quoting from Jefferson's autobiography, he says, where the preamble to the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which is, by the way, one of the three things on his tombstone that he was most proud of, that he was the author of, that, the creation of the University of Virginia, and the Declaration of Independence. Doesn't even say that this guy was president. Right? Anyhow, back to his autobiography. He says, where the preamble to the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom declares that coercion is a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion. An amendment was proposed by inserting the word Jesus Christ. So it should read, a departure from the plan of Jesus Christ, the holy author of our religion. The insertion, so he's talking about the debate before the Virginia House of Burgesses. And this is on the Virginia Resolution for Religious Liberty. In other words, the government shall not interfere with your religion. He said, the insertion of Jesus Christ was rejected by a great majority in proof that they meant to comprehend within the mantle of its protection, of the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, within the mantle of its protection, the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mohammedan, the Hindu and the infidel of every denomination. This is from his autobiography, from Notes on Virginia. He says, the legitimate powers of government extend to such actions as only are injurious to others. It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my will. I could go on, but I won't. I just wanted to make the point. It really concerns me when the Supreme Court and the preachers of America are conspiring together, as Jefferson said, in truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So Madison's fear that government money would corrupt the churches has come true. And Jefferson's fear that the churches would corrupt our government has come true. What do we do now? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Karen, listening on KBCS in Federal Way, Washington. And by the way, let me just once more, if I may, Karen, for just a second here, mention that today is Give Big Day in Seattle, a one-day fundraiser sponsored by the Seattle Foundation. And if you're listening to KBCS, you can go to kbcs.fm or call them at 425-564-5000. And whatever you give will be doubled. It'll be matched by the Seattle Foundation. So, Karen, what's up?
Well, here's the deal. I think that people who follow the Norse gods should seize upon this opportunity given them by the Supreme Court and demand to say prayers to Forseti, the Norse god, who is the presider over justice, who is the son of Baldur, the god of light, and of Nanna, goddess of immaculate purity.
Mm-hmm.
And to demand accountability, responsibility, and transparency.
I don't disagree. What is baffling me is where are the people from the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, the Church of Satan Worshippers, the Church of Loki, or of the, you know, the you're talking about, right, the Norse gods.
Well, Loki is not a very good character.
I know, Loki. But he was the trickster, you know. The trickster, he's kind of the shaman's friend, you know. But in any case, do you know anybody who actually practices this as a religion rather than, you know, merely?
No, and Forseti is kind of an obscure god anyway, but
yeah.
I thought he should be brought up into the light, and let's start invoking the old fella.
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting one, when Louise and I I think it was either the year before or the year after 9/11. It was the year before 9/11. We were in Egypt with our old church group, the Coptic church from Michigan, and we had this tour guide who was who has since passed away, but we kept in touch with, who was a anthropologist and archaeologist, an Egyptian man, and I'm sorry I can't remember his name. It's been years, but he got us inside the pyramid, and I even got to lay down inside the sarcophagus way up in the top of one of the main pyramids, you know. But anyhow, he took us down to Luxor, and he was talking about how when Alexander the Great conquered Egypt, that he claimed, he was reading an inscription, and he says, this is more modern, this is only 2,000 years old, and this is from, or 3,000 years old, it's from Alexander the Great's conquest of Egypt, and it says, I am the reincarnation of the great god Amen. And I was like, Amen? And he was like, yeah, he says, the highest of all the Egyptian gods, the oldest, the most ancient of all the Egyptian gods was named Amen, A-M-E-N. And we still pray to him. We end every prayer by invoking his name. And it totally blew my mind. I was like, wow. You know, and so, you know, maybe it's time for us to start the Church of Amen or something. I don't know. Except, you know, that would be, that's subtle enough, it would probably be lost on a lot of people.
All right. Well, but, I think we could have a bit of fun with it.
I think we could, too. It'd make good guerrilla theater. It's just, it's too many people are working too many hours and don't have the time to do these kind of things like they used to. Karen, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to KBCS, which is having a one-day fundraiser today. You can give them a call at 425-564-5000. We'll be right back. WHMP gig, you know, the website makes it look like they're going to give away three tickets or something. There's going to be room for a couple hundred people there, so just, you know, sign up. It's going to be fun. One last thing I meant to open the hour with this. Every now and then, I have a friend who is running for Congress. He's in Georgia. He's a Republican, and he's bragging about the fact that he helped. He helped fight against expanding Medicaid in the state legislature, and now he wants to run for federal. I'm not going to name him because Ed's like a friend, and I mean we helped start this entrepreneurs club together of a bunch of guys who are entrepreneurs, and we get together once a month, and the group is still around, I haven't seen most of these guys in 20 years, but they're old friends. But every now and then, and he's a decent guy in a lot of respects. I don't agree with all his policies, but every now and then you see something from one of these Republicans, and you go, you know, maybe there's something to this. Let me just share this story. Emily Schulfeis, I think is how her name is. It looks how her name is spelled. Is writing over in Politico. Bob Johnson, a doctor and Republican candidate in Georgia's solidly red 1st District, said at a February candidate forum that the TSA is indoctrinating Americans. He said, quote, "Now this is going to sound outrageous. I'd rather see another terrorist attack, truly I would, than to give up my liberty as an American citizen. Give me liberty or give me death." Isn't that what Patrick Henry said at the founding of our republic? And then he said that the TSA is indoctrinating generations of Americans to walk through a line and be prodded and probed by uniformed personnel, agents of the government, like sheep. Now, I would not say I'd rather see a terrorist attack. And he came out later and said, in the heat of the moment, while making a point that I would much rather fight the enemy than our federal government, I said something stupid, and he should have chosen his words more carefully. He's stepped back from that. But there is something fundamentally, it seems, un-American about all of this. And it's not like the TSA are bad guys. In fact, you'll recall back when I was doing our show from Portland, one day I was going through the airport and a TSA guy in a turban, a Sikh, came over. And said, "You're Tom Hartman, aren't you?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he says, "Hey, I'm, you know, getting off. You want to go have lunch?" So we went over and we had lunch together. I'm having lunch with this TSA guy. And it turned out, you know, he listened to the show and we had a wonderful conversation. And when I gave my talk in Portland last week, he was there and he was one of the people up on stage with me. Cool guy. There's decent people who work for the TSA. I don't think he's... still works for the TSA now, but he's. I mean, there's good people that work for the TSA. But this whole "be afraid, be very afraid" thing that George W. Bush sold us, you know, with Tom Ridge in the 2004 election, jacking up the terror alerts every time there was a good John Kerry news cycle, and all that kind of stuff, and you know the continuous expansion of the police state, I'm concerned about this. So anyhow, I've thrown a bunch of stuff out here from, you know, crashes to religion to politics to TSA to and we've got more coming. In the next hour, Dr. Michael Mann is going to be with us to talk about the climate gig, you know, thing that the federal government just released today. And in our third hour, Marianne Williamson is going to be with us, and she's going to be taking your calls. So get ready. That's going to be fun. Donald in Chicago. Hey, Donald. Thanks for listening to WCPT. You want to talk about the religion ruling in the Supreme Court?
Yes. That is so frightening, Tom, because you want to know something? There's a lot of people in this country that wrap themselves in religion and the flag. And the truth of the matter is next thing you know, they're going to start taking passages from the Bible to support their twisted convictions.
Well, they already have.
Ryan.
They already do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and this is the old Sinclair Lewis quote. I think it was Sinclair Lewis who in It Can't Happen Here said, you know, when fascism comes to America, it'll be wearing a coonskin cap and carrying a cross.
Yeah.
So.
And not only that, there too. It already has. I remember when Paul Ryan said, and correct me if I'm wrong. You know, there is a passage in the Bible about helping the poor and feeding the poor, but he turns it around and uses. He uses the passage that says, don't feed a man a fish, teach him how to fish. Or that, something
yeah,
that.
Which and there is no such passage. It's just actually what happened was Jesus fed the, you know, he did a miracle. I think that don't teach a man how to fish or don't feed a man, teach him how to fish. That's a quote from Ben Franklin. It's one of Ben's many nice aphorisms. Donald, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Kurt, listening to WSTE in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, great show. Thanks for being on our local progressive station. Wanted to say in my mind, thinking about the recent ruling of the Supreme Court about the rights of gay people, in that religions that are expressly fighting against those people's rights, everybody's...
Expressly homophobic.
They should be denied their 501c3 tax deductions.
Well, I think all religions except for monasteries... should be. I think, you know, monasteries have no way of making money, so they can't pay property taxes. They should be tax exempt. But I think we just need to do away with the tax exemption for all other religions. There's no need for it.
I can support that. I'm trying to start something called Earth Worship Nation, which is a mystical humanism that says, you know, genetics and biochemistry are the primal words of God.
Cool.
And, you know,
that's great. And the odds are that you will not show such a profit that you ever have to worry about paying taxes. So, you know, this is the tax exempt status really benefits people like Pat Robertson and, you know, not the average small church. So, Kurt, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for listening to WSTE. We will be back coming up on the top of the hour. Dr. Michael Mann will be with us, and climate change is already here. Oh, what was Fox News' advice on this, by the way? Benghazi!
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Michael Mann, climate scientist, professor, and director of the Penn State Earth Systems Science Center. His website, michaelmann.net. And the author, I don't have it in my bio for you, Dr. Mann. I'm sorry. Your most recent book was?
Oh, it's The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars.
The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Thank you. It's brilliant. My memory for things like that is terrible. So tell us, what did the federal government just tell us?
Thanks, Tom. It's always great to be with you. So I know it's sort of feeling like the movie Groundhog Day, because I think we had a conversation very much like this one just about a month ago when the IPCC released their latest report on climate change impacts, the conclusion of which was that climate change is no longer a distant problem. It's something that is impacting us negatively now, where we live. And this latest report by the U.S. National Climate Assessment, this is an assessment by American scientists, but it's a similarly authoritative, heavily reviewed assessment of the state of the science. They come to more or less the same conclusion. The bottom line of this latest report is that climate change is impacting us here in the U.S. negatively now, when it comes to extreme weather, when it comes to increasing coastal flooding from sea level rise combined with increasingly strong hurricanes, drought, epic drought over large parts of the south central U.S. and the western U.S., record heat, and record wildfire. We are seeing the symptoms of human-caused climate change play out before us. And that's basically what this report is telling us yet again. Hopefully, the message is starting to get through. The science is in on this. Climate change is real. It's caused by us, and it's already a problem. It will be much worse if we don't do something about it.
Well, and in fact, it looked to me like this report is suggesting that within maybe two generations, by the 2070s roughly, most of the United States would have a climate not that different or not that dissimilar from Phoenix, Arizona right now.
That's right. I mean, what we can actually see this if you look at...
looking at the front cover of the report.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if you talk to gardeners, you talk to people who spend a lot of time outdoors, they'll tell you that we are seeing... an increasingly early spring in many parts of the country. That might not have been true this year. We had an unusually cold winter over large parts of the U.S. But if you look at the trend, if you look at the trend over 10 years, 20 years, the longer-term trends, we are seeing a very clear movement towards earlier springs, towards, you know, basically the a state like Nebraska increasingly having the climate of a state like Kansas, and a state like Kansas having more of the climate of a state like Oklahoma. And so we're already seeing that march of climate zones poleward with fairly dire impacts.
Right. And this late spring that we saw, there are those who suggest that the mechanism might have been that the temperature gradient, the difference in temperature between the mid-latitudes where we are and the northern latitudes, the polar latitudes, used to be great enough that a giant wall of air, a barrier of air, kept the jet stream to the north and kept that polar air to the north. And that because the Arctic is warming so much faster than the mid-latitudes are warming, and please correct me if any of my language on this is wrong, but because that's warming so much more rapidly, that difference, that gradient, that difference in temperature has diminished to the point where that wall of air can no longer keep the jet stream way up there north and thus keep the Arctic air north. So the Arctic air is sliding out of the mid-latitudes where it is gathering heat and then taking it back up to the Arctic and speeding up further the rate at which the Arctic is melting.
Yeah, I mean, and this is sort of at the, you know, the forefront of where the science is, and there's still a debate within the climate research community about, you know, the precise relationships here. Mm-hmm. But there does seem to be mounting evidence, multiple studies now that suggest that the melting of Arctic sea ice, which is warming the very high latitudes, and it is, as you say, it's changing the sort of variations of temperature with latitude, and it's those variations of temperature with latitude and with altitude in the atmosphere that actually determine the jet stream, where it is.
Right.
And so those changes in Arctic sea ice and the changes in temperature that are associated with that are changing the jet stream potentially in a way that favors the sort of winter that we just saw, where we had, yes, cold conditions back east, but we had unusually warm conditions on the west coast over a large part of the western U.S., record temperatures in part of Alaska, record drought in California, and flooding in the Pacific Northwest because of that migration of the jet stream that normally would bring moisture to California, much needed winter moisture to Southern California, instead veered north.
Because the thing that is regulating the jet stream now, instead of being temperature gradients and air currents, is simple geography. It's hitting the mountains down the Alaskan coast and down through Alaska and all the way down to Arizona, I guess, where the Rockies pretty much kind of peter out.
Yeah, the jet stream sort of likes to lock into certain configurations that are more or less determined by the orography, where the mountain ranges are. And because of that, it can tend to sort of flip from one state to another, rather than just sort of moving gradually. Because of things like mountain ranges, it has certain preferred configurations, and we may be pushing it into a different configuration, favoring a configuration that gives us the sort of winter that we saw. And again, that's being debated within the scientific community, but there's increasing evidence that that may be a real connection. And if it's true, it means that drought in California may actually become worse than the current models even project.
Right. And it also, from what I've read, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on this, it also could suggest that we are more aggressively transferring heat from the latitudes where we live up to the polar region than we would be otherwise, when this air mass basically slides down over us and then slides back up over the, you know, it's like a yarmulke sliding off the side of the head and then back, you know, kind of thing. Does
right.
That make sense?
I mean, there are a whole bunch of potential sort of unexpected, you know, surprises that may be in store because of, you know, the vagaries of how this system works. And we're still working out the details, but, you know, that's not something to give us comfort. What it means is that we could be in for, you know, other surprises, surprises that don't work out in our favor.
Yes. And this report, I haven't read word for word. I've read a good chunk of it. I didn't see anything about even, you know, some of the more out of the edge ones, like the one that I talked about in that video we did about, you know, what happens if the methane starts melting in the Arctic. This is a very conservative report.
Oh, and these reports always are. These are assessment reports, which means they're, you know, written by typically, you know, tens if not hundreds of scientists and many more hundreds of contributors who provide input. And so by its nature, it's sort of a lowest common denominator, scientifically speaking. It is, you know, the conclusions are those conclusions which a large number of climate scientists can agree upon. Right. And because of that, by its nature, it's a conservative report. And so what should concern us is the fact that these very conservative assessment reports, like the IPCC report that came out last month in this latest national assessment report here in the U.S. that just came out today, the fact that these very conservative reports are portraying climate change impacts in as dire a way as they are, it tells us that there really is a problem here.
Yeah, and it could be a hell of a lot worse than we think.
Yeah.
Dr. Michael Mann, author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, michaelmann.net, his M-A-N-N, his website. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Tom.
Ditto. Back at you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mann, one of the, I think, one of the finest scientists in America. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, we had a caller in the last hour, I said, from WST. It's WFT, as in Frank. My apologies. Get that right. Wrong mouse. There we go. Steve, in Haymarket, Virginia, listening on the Sirius app. Hey, Steve, what's up?
I was listening very carefully to that, and I still have not heard any solution other than we, you know, live in caves and die at age 35. What is Dr. Mann going to do when people start dying of starvation because of energy poverty, which is the only logical thing that can happen if you get rid of fuels that have fossils in them?
You're a pessimist, aren't you, Steve? You're a pessimist, aren't you? I mean, can you not imagine? I mean, go back and look at the United States at the changes from, say, roughly 1850 to 1900. You know, we went from, well, let's say 1830 to 1900. We went from virtually no national railroad. You know, the B&O started in 1831, a little railroad in Baltimore. Virtually no national railroad to being coast-to-coast connected. We went from the cotton gin being rolled into the marketplace in 1831 to the full-blown Industrial Revolution, manufacturing automobiles. We had over 100 different companies making automobiles at the turn of the century, 1900. We dramatically changed the face, the nature, the topography, the quality of life of this country, largely as a consequence of Colonel Drake drilling that oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1865, the first commercially viable oil well in the United States. The Industrial Revolution fueled by first steam and then fossil fuels. Can't you imagine a new Industrial Revolution fueled by this massive fusion reactor 93 million miles away from us?
Well, I mean, that's the alternative, but unfortunately, we haven't perfected that yet. And I mean,
why not?
I'm an optimist. They're saying they're going to have a fusion reactor on Earth in 20 years. I think it'll happen in 10 years because we double the sum total of mankind's knowledge every 12 hours. So tomorrow morning, me, you, and Dr. Mann, for that matter, don't know anything.
Well, it's, you know,
that's important that that's we a, understand
that's a glib
the
characterization of the amount
of the absorbed.
It's a glib characterization of the amount of information on the internet. It doesn't, you know, it's not the sum total of human knowledge. A and B, I just I'm with Julian Simon on this, the famous conservative that you know, we have this extraordinary thing called the brain. And when we figure out that we are poisoning ourselves and our planet by burning fossils, and we can now, I mean, now you've got, if the fossil fuel industry was paying for its true costs, its actual externalities, ranging from the cost of protecting the Gulf, you know, oil coming over to the United States with our naval costs, to the wars we fight for it, to just the, you know, the cancers and the asthmas and the climate change. If the fossil fuel industry was paying for that, right now solar and wind are less expensive. You got over 20% of the electricity in Iowa and Texas being generated by wind power. Steve, I'm not ready to give up. You know, I know the folks over at Fox. I mean, you know, Gretchen Carlson, I think it was her advice. Is Dana Perino? Dana Perino. She says, there's going to be the president's going to have a press conference on climate change. Be sure to ask her about Benghazi. Really? Minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. Welcome back. Okay, so it's the end of the world as we know it. Is it? I don't know. I'm feeling fine. Oh, a Benghazi scandal that actually could have some legs. You know, Dana Perino earlier today, or maybe it was yesterday afternoon, whenever it was, I saw it on the internet this morning. Over in Fox News, Dana Perino, who was formerly one of Bush's press secretaries, wasn't she? She was the face of the Bush administration back when they were lying us into wars and things. So it's appropriate, of course, she should be at Fox News. She pointed out that this U.S. National Climate Assessment, now this is the last page of this has the logos of all the government agencies that contributed to this. And a couple of them I can't read because they're like, you know, light type on dark background. But Department of Commerce, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, Department of Human Services, Department of the Interior, the President, the Department of State, the Department of Transportation, the EPA, NASA, the National Science Foundation, the Smithsonian Institution, United States International Development Agency, AID. These are the groups that contributed to this climate change climate change impacts in the United States. And they're saying basically it's already happening and it's already getting bad. And you think it's bad now, it's going to get worse and it's going to start getting worse fast. And we got to do something about this. So Dana Perino said the president's going to come out and he's going to talk about this, which he's probably done by this point. And when he does, you reporters who are there, be sure to ask him about Benghazi. Okay, so here's the question that I have about Benghazi. Laura Logan put together about a year ago a phony baloney report for 60 Minutes about Benghazi. It was filled with lies and misinformation, apparently, to the point that CBS has asked LexisNexis to remove it from their database, citing copyright. You can't even find this thing anymore. And now it turns out that she was consulting with Congress, with Senator Lindsey Graham, who is not in the 60 Minutes piece, but as soon as it came out, started quoting it. So Laura Logan and Lindsey Graham were conspiring with CBS, and where the question is, you know, what did CBS management know and when did they know it? We're conspiring with CBS to make Hillary Clinton and President Obama look bad, to make it look like there was this massive intelligence failure. That Benghazi was the consequence not just of a video and unrest in the Middle East, but some kind of horrible thing that they were trying to cover up. That they should have seen this coming. That it was as bad as if somebody from the CIA had flown to Hawaii to sit down with the president and given him a daily presidential briefing that said Bin Laden determined to strike in the United, excuse me, that said Benghazi guys determined to strike in Benghazi. And he ignored it for several months until those four guys died. That it was almost as bad as when George Bush on August 6th, 2001 was given the daily intelligence briefing where the CIA sent a special guy down to Texas, down to the Crawford Ranch, because they thought he wasn't taking this seriously. And the daily presidential briefing, the DPB, was titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike Inside the U.S. And George Bush patted him on the leg and said, okay, son, you've done your job. You've covered your ass. Go back to D.C. So Fox wants us to think that the level of intelligence failure that the Bush administration had that led right to 9/11, that allowed 9/11 to happen, and the level of cover-up of lies that were told after the fact about it for Benghazi is similar to what happened with 9/11. When apparently it's just like not the case at all. I mean, not even remotely. But what I don't get, what finally, you know, what has me, but Laura Logan and Lindsey Graham were working this thing to make the president look bad, and I'd like to know more about that. I think that's worthy of a Senate investigation. So, Senator Reid, if you're listening, or anybody in your staff, here's something to think about. While they're putting together a committee over in the House, the Republicans control the House, you and the Democrats control the Senate, while they're putting together a committee in the House to investigate Benghazi, why don't you do the same thing? And look into this. Into Senator Graham and the others who would politicize this. I mean, remember the Navy SEAL, former Navy SEAL, he was a private contractor who died, and Ambassador Stevens' wife, the father of the Navy SEAL and Ambassador Stevens' wife, have both publicly asked that the death of their son and husband, respectively, not be politicized. Which, of course, is being completely ignored by John Boehner and his buddies over at the House of Representatives, the Republicans. But how can these guys even seriously say Benghazi? Intelligence failure, cover-up, Benghazi, four guys died. After what George Bush did with the intelligence failure and cover-ups around 9/11, and I'm not even talking about any kind of conspiracy theory here, I'm talking about the stuff that's a matter of public record, and Iraq. Oh, we've got aluminum tubes. When Condi said that, she was lying, and she knew she was lying. Jon Stewart did a brilliant takedown on this last night on the comedy show. He is so good. He is so good. Why don't the Democrats pick this up? Why is it not that every time Lindsey Graham says, Benghazi, somebody goes, 9/11, Iraq? I mean, you know, like parrots.
Oh, I want a cracker.
Yeah. I mean, this could be a big deal. Anyhow, we'll be back with your thoughts on my thoughts on the news. We've covered a lot of territory right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Michael Mann's site and his blogs on the climate stuff. It's michaelmann.net. We'll be back. Good, the bad, and the very, very piranimously ugly, the good. Mozilla, a company behind the web browser Firefox, announced yesterday that it had filed a request with the FCC to change its rules regarding net neutrality so that Internet service providers are covered under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. In other words, Mozilla is asking the FCC to classify Internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon as common carriers, which is the single best way to preserve net neutrality. Many internet companies talk loudly about protecting a free and open internet, but when push comes to shove, very few of them actually follow through on their promises. Good on Mozilla for following through on its promises and sticking up for real net neutrality. Let me remind you, by the way, that the Department of Homeland Security has said if you're using a PC, don't use Internet Explorer because it's not secure. Mozilla makes Firefox, which competes. Just saying. Anyhow, the bad. Dana Perino. During last night's episode of The Five, the Fox News host and former White House press secretary said that she hoped the meteorologist meeting with President Obama today to talk about climate change asked him about Benghazi. Yes, Benghazi. Check it out.
Tomorrow, President Obama is going to do interviews with meteorologists all across the country about a new climate change report.
Yes, because the science is settled.
I hope they ask him about Benghazi.
Yeah, there you go.
And from, like, Montana, I should ask him about Benghazi. That'd be great. Dare you.
Right. Dana may have been trying to make a joke, but given Fox's recent dive into full-on Benghazi mania, we'll never know for sure. Saddest part of it all, though, is that it was probably Fox's most informative climate change segment of the week. And the very, very ugly Stacey Campfield. In a blog post he wrote on Monday, the Republican Tennessee state senator compared Obamacare to the Holocaust. He wrote, Democrats bragging about the number of mandatory signups for Obamacare is like Germans bragging about the number of mandatory signups for train rides for Jews in the 40s. As if that wasn't bad enough, Campfield doubled down on his comments today, writing in a follow-up blog entry that people missed the point of his post. The point, he said, was not to offend, it was to warn, to draw attention to Obamacare and the slippery slope that I see occurring with the continued taking of freedom by the federal government. Basically, Stacey Campfield still thinks helping people get access to affordable health care is like an act of genocide. The fact that anyone could think this way is just very, very ugly. And bizarre. I mean, just bizarre. Peter in Monticello, Florida. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Yeah, I was just still thinking about that Benghazi thing.
Yeah.
First place, they never talk about how they illegally invaded Libya. Total war crime there. But then they made a deal with the CIA. I think that's the real problem. Obama can't work with the CIA, with Al-Qaeda. They used to be our enemy, and now they're shipping arms to Syria using Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
So they're actually making a business deal with Al-Qaeda, who was our enemy, to ship the arms to Syria.
Well, what the White House will tell you is that they're trying to work with Sunnis in the region who are not Al-Qaeda, but it's...
Well, they tell us they tell us what they think
it's a very, very messy situation, and yes, I think that we are ending up in Syria supporting Al-Qaeda, and it's not a good thing. I'm with you on that. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Yeah, when you just had a caller on one of the breaks that said talked about new technology. We need new technology for energy.
Yeah.
And that's one of the biggest myths, actually crimes, I'd say, perpetrated against us, in that we don't need any new technology other than batteries to solve our energy and climate problems.
Right.
And I just want to go through a quick list of why I say that. First, problem's behavior. talked about that before, where at least a third of our energy is used to do absolutely nothing.
Right.
And probably
turn off lights at night.
Yeah, but even right now, if somebody's got a cell phone charger plugged in with that, the DVRs, those use 40 watts of energy day in and day out. Whether, so if you're watching TV 3 hours a day, that's, yeah,
yeah,
21 hours where it's wasting energy.
Right.
And then, you know, why do our cities glow at 3 a.m. when 99% of us are in bed?
Right.
And right now, some of my neighbors in 50-degree nights have been running their air conditioning. 20 degrees colder outside than they need their house. All you have to do is open windows.
Right.
But then the next part is efficiency. Like Norway, their houses now, they're reducing energy usage on the new ones by 75%.
Oh, they've got houses in Norway now, and this is like, you know, in the Arctic Circle, where that can be heated with a single 100-watt light bulb.
Yes.
They've got houses that are heated by body heat.
Exactly. And then in Florida, they did a study, and they showed by just putting lighter shingles on and increasing the size of the eaves on the houses, you can reduce air conditioning by 35%.
Wow.
But as far as new technology, well, prairie dogs designed the burrows to use natural air conditioning. They changed the difference in the height of the entrance and exits of their burrows depending on the heat and their airspeed.
Right.
Persians cooled their houses with wind catchers over 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, there's still. We have a friend who was just in Iran about 3 months ago, and he visited this ancient city where people live sort of underground not underground, but I mean the roofs of all the buildings form the top, kind of the top of the city, and they've got these giant tunnels and air things and all kinds of, and it's like air conditioning.
Yeah, and chimneys.
Yeah.
They've got chimneys. Basically, they're paying attention that heat rises.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also, there's also saying, you know, countercurrent exchange and also laminar flow. But there are simple things that anyone in science should know. But build these big chimneys, the air gets sucked up out of your house, you bring it in from underground, you get cool air. No fans needed.
Right.
And fans are a huge part of our energy usage.
Yeah.
But right now, the Anasazi, I mean, they heated their homes in the sun. You can go on a very hot day to Bandelier National Monument just near Santa Fe, and it'll be over 100-degree day, and you go in one of their houses there, and you're 10 feet from the outside with it, you know, totally open to the outside, and it's 30 degrees cooler.
Right.
But then we could replace almost all natural gas use and much electric use by just merely using mostly passive, and act with solar, wind, and gas, the local infinite energies.
Right.
But we need, and right now in South Africa, I urge all your listeners right now to do a search to South Africa solar hot water, and you'll be shocked. You'll see tin shacks with solar hot water all over the country.
Yeah, well, I saw these all over the Middle East back 30 years ago.
Yeah, well, as I said before, Sidon, Israel, are well over 90% solar hot water in those countries.
Yeah.
And they are not high per capita income countries.
No, and it gets cold at night, too, by the way, most of the year.
Yeah. And Cyprus, they exceeded 91% solar hot water on their residential buildings in 1993. Israel's been mandating solar hot water since 1980. We do not need new technology. We already know how to do it. It's just simply... And the thing is, it's all ridiculously simple. That's the really scary part.
I'm with you. Jeff, may I give you a ProFlowers gift certificate?
Sure.
Okay, from our underwriter, ProFlowers.com. I'm going to put Jeff on hold. He's on line one. Remarkable. Okay. Bob in Marcells, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Oh, not a whole lot, except you mentioned something very interesting, and that was Nexus Lexus. And CBS, and basically, it fits in so well with everything involved in the news about information over the course of the last 2 years. The NSA, Google's records of what you do, and basically, there are two information systems. Still, even after 30 years of the web, we have people with Westlaw and Nexus and Lexis and every other goofy thing that have access to it, whether it's a university library or a corporate account that we don't get when we get to Google. In fact, we don't even get a decent web search when we get to Google. We get stuff that's sorted six different ways, none of which are the ways we pick. And NexusLexis, the fact that that CBS likes to edit it, that's really scary.
Yeah. Well, they're dealing with a major embarrassment here. They are trying to pretend that they're a solid, incredible news organization, and you know, one of their stars, you know, was working with a partisan Republican, Lindsey Graham, to smear the president, and it's out now. Bob, thanks for the call. Robert in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Robert, what's up? You want to talk about the Keystone Pipeline, Robert? Robert is apparently not listening to his phone. Barbara, listening to WHMP in Hatfield, Mass. Hey, Barbara, you wanted to comment on Benghazi?
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Good. What's up?
I'm in shock today. I'm even on the phone with you, but I want to get to it. I want to talk about the pipeline, but I want to talk about all the pipeline, because it's not just the pipeline, the XL pipeline. It's the pipelines they're trying to put in up here. And I'm in Hampshire County, but in Franklin County, where I used to live, they're running a pipeline through my town, and the gas industry is pushing this, and now the Secretary of Energy, Ernest Moniz, I don't know how to pronounce, but he was down in Connecticut like 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he's, you know, planting the seeds.
Yeah.
Because it's like the Northeast is, you know, it fell behind.
Oh, have you ever seen a map of the gas pipelines of the United States? It's like looking at those, that kind of visible person, you know, where you can see the whole vascular system of the body. It's amazing, the pipeline infrastructure that we have. And what's so amazing is a lot of it dates back to the 19th century. Barbara, thank you for the call. This is something that people need to know about, what's going on in their own hometown. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Barbara, thank you for listening to WHMP. I look forward to seeing you this weekend. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I'm trying to print my my little email from Shane here of my 13 Benghazis. Which are probably more appropriate for a debate than for just a rant. But anyway. Gene in Dover, Illinois, watching us on Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi. You know, I've always been wondering about this. I wonder why, like during World War II, I was a kid, and they had gas rationing. I wonder why they
gasoline.
Don't have that now. Wouldn't that help where people could take trains and, you know, there'd be less driving, and it would help with our, you know, problems
yeah.
that we have.
Yeah, I think the way to the appropriate way to ration it would probably be, since there are now alternatives to gasoline, we have a better public transit system than we had in the 40s, and we have non-gasoline vehicles, would be to simply raise the price of it. Back during the 40s, there were so many people who were so dependent upon gasoline that FDR came up with a rationing program rather than a market-based program, as it were. But I think that we should.
So that wouldn't help at all to have, then people would drive less and be wouldn't be.
Well, what it would do is it would produce a black market in gasoline. I mean, it's rationing rarely works. Richard Nixon tried it, you know, in the 70s. I remember that, and I'm not old enough to remember World War II, but I remember 70, 71, 72, 73, whatever year that was, that Nixon went to odd even gas rationing, and you couldn't buy more than one tank, and you had to buy it on an odd or even day and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it didn't work. What it did was it produced long lines and fistfights. So,
okay.
But I think that if we were to simply say, you know, gasoline, burning gasoline is costing us, you know, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars because of global warming. And we're going to recover some of that cost by putting a tax on the gasoline and using that money to pay for FEMA, you know, for the Emergency Management Agency. Then you would discover that people would be moving to solar and to wind and to electric cars and things like that, because it would be cheaper. They would simply be cheaper. And that's, you know, those alternatives are there now that didn't exist during World War II. And frankly, it didn't exist in the 70s in a big way. Jimmy Carter really started pushing that stuff in the late 70s, but the state of the art now is so much better. So Gene, I think you're onto something. But the way to do it is I think with what they call a carbon tax or a carbon fee and rebate. In fact, you can even give back to the people all the money that we make from the carbon fee. And what it does is that reduces the impact on people who drive a lot for work, you know, who have no choice, people who live in rural areas or rural states. There are ways to kind of balance this out. So anyway, Gene,
well,
thank you very much for the call.
Answered my question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. I think that there, you know, this idea of a gas tax of a carbon tax is an idea whose time has come. Denmark did this 15 years ago. And you go to Copenhagen. I've been there a couple times in the last few years. And probably half the city is driving bicycles right now. And what has happened? You know, heart disease rate goes down. The imported oil consumption goes down. Quality of life goes up. Cost of life goes down. I mean, it's just a good thing. Anyhow, we'll be back in just a moment with Bob Nabel, Talk Radio News. Stick around. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, and Bob Ney of the Talk Radio News Service, former U.S. Congressman and author of the brilliant book, Sideswiped. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. So, what's in the news today?
Well, you know, there's I'm not going to say the usual stories of Benghazi and Ukraine, of course, but I did want to highlight, beyond the announcement of the White House, which I'm sure you're talking about with the climate change, and the Republicans are immediately saying the president's using this as a political tool, et cetera. So you're seeing complete denial.
Political tool for what purpose?
Mitch McConnell indicates maybe the president wants to hurt the middle-class working people who will pay for this.
By what? Not extending their long-term unemployment benefits?
By using the climate control report.
I don't get how that hurts the middle class.
Obviously they had to answer something. You're seeing the stage set right there of basically denial of all.
Do you think that there's ever going to be a serious Benghazi investigation into the Laura Logan, Lindsey Graham, CBS Benghazi cover-up mess lie?
You mean drag Lindsay before the committee, the select committee?
Yeah, and Laura.
I don't think they'll do that, but, if Lindsay went, they'd have to take McCain, so they'd have to have two seats.
Yeah. I mean, because what you've got there is an actual scandal, you know, an actual lie and an actual cover-up and the whole thing, you know,
Lindsey Graham never stops on this issue. I mean, this is his number one everything.
Yeah, I know. That's why, you know, I think that I would like to know what he was telling Laura Logan that caused her to embarrass herself so badly on television that she has not yet been back.
He's been obsessed with this because there's just nothing else there that he wants to talk about except this issue, period.
Yeah.
And I do want to mention two stories I found very interesting. One is going to be in the embryo stage. And there was a misstep on his part of the statement he made last year, and I'm talking about Attorney General Eric Holder. And it was in relation to a statement he had made before a committee, basically that, you know, they were afraid if you went after banks criminally, then the whole bank would falter. But what he's saying is that there is a way to begin to look at this. So the question is, can the prosecutor bring criminal charges against a bank without rocking the financial system? And this has been around kind of dogging the attorney general for the past couple of years, but he's beginning to make statements towards looking into that issue.
Yeah, this is the pushback on the too big to jail thing.
Yes, and you know the scenario, and I think people are aware by now that they get this great big fine, $150, $200 million, but they've made so much money on the other end that the fine is nothing. There's no criminal side to it. Because it's like you can't take a president of a bank or an individual culpable out there without the, quote, entire banking system failing, which I think, you know, is not accurate. So the attorney general is beginning to talk about this issue, and I think this is just the beginning of an argument that eventually will have its day, you know, before the lawmaking bodies.
Yeah.
And the other story is that this is coming from states, four states right now, but The states are trying to grow a right to try bill, as it's called, where lawmakers want the FDA to let terminally ill patients use unapproved drugs versus the 10-year wait to when the drugs come on the market. And now, you know, there's an argument that, is made, some within the FDA say, well, you know, the side effects to this can be bad. Well, these people are terminal, and they would like to have the chance to have some of these experimental drugs, because currently it takes the FDA about 10 years to complete that clinical trial on a new drug. So, but you're seeing this come from an interesting area from within the states towards the federal government, saying that ought to be
done. I'm curious about that. One of my kids' fiancés died of leukemia last year and went through a whole series of experimental drugs. And we went to, you know, we were with him for part of this stuff. And he really went through hell. I mean, you know, all bloated up and all kinds of stuff. And my friend Tim Carpenter just died this week, the founder, co-founder of Progressive Democrats of America. And he had metastasized melanoma. And he had been on an experimental drug in one of these trial phases, and it seemed to have extended his life by several years. So he had good results. My daughter's fiance had bad results, or who knows? I mean, but these drugs are not unavailable, and you know, once they've demonstrated some efficacy, they're not that hard to get. I'm wondering if this is a genuine grassroots thing, or is this the pharmaceutical companies lobbying to have easier access to guinea pigs?
Well, you know, that is the debate of the issue. I mean, one has to be careful of that it's not from within the pharmaceutical community just to get their drugs out on the market earlier, you know, for monetary purposes.
Yeah, because, I mean, in some case, they got busted pretty badly about, what, 5-6 years ago for trying out some of these drugs in third world countries? Remember that?
Oh, yes.
It was
yes.
a huge scandal. I think it was going on in India and Bangladesh, where they had, you know, all these people who were dying from these drugs that really had not been approved for stage three trials here in the United States. They were doing the equivalent of stage three. They hadn't gone through stage one. You know, does it work? Stage two, does it kill anybody? Stage three, what's the appropriate dosage? Stage four, you know, long term, does it work? And that, as I recall, those are the stages. I could be totally wrong, but you know. But in any case, they were jumping the line, you know, in these third world countries, and it sounds like they want to do that here. So, you know, I'm very suspicious of the pharmaceutical companies.
And it's to be careful, and one has to be careful, especially the pharmaceutical companies. But I thought it's a story that happening in four states. Now, if they are behind it, I would assume or would hope that eventually that would be found out. But
well, I wonder if it's ALEC legislation. If it's in four states, if the American Legislative Exchange Council is pushing it, which would mean it's coming out of the Republican Party, which means it is coming out of the pharmaceutical companies, who are members of ALEC.
I tried to find that out. Of course, I'm familiar with ALEC from my legislative days in the state legislature. But so far, I know California was one of the states.
Yeah.
And I was just going to take an eye out just to watch this as it progresses a little bit. I thought these were two stories.
Just take a look at the sponsors. The sponsors are almost all Republicans. It's very high probability it's an ALEC deal.
I would agree.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, author of Sideswiped. If you haven't read it, get it. It's an amazing book. You want to know what's really going on in Washington, D.C.? You want to know why John Boehner's really orange? Read Bob Ney's book. Bob, thank you.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
listening to the Tom Hart Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Marianne Williamson is on the line with us. She is a candidate for the United States House of Representatives in Henry Waxman's old district, which is California 33, isn't it, Marianne?
Hi, it's Marianne. I'm so sorry we can't get on visual Skype, but I'm here on the phone. Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. Okay, the website is Marianne, M-A-R-I-A-N-N-E, 4-F-O-R, congress.com, and author of 10 books, lecturer and thought leader, Marianne. And a great piece about you in the L.A. Times last week, by the way. I just wanted to, there were things that I could have quibbled with about it, but it's like, well, what was it P.T. Barnum said, you know, spell my name right? I think it was a good start. So what as you're traveling around the 33rd District of California, which is in the Los Angeles area, and running for this seat that Henry Waxman is vacating, what are you hearing from the people? What are you hearing from what are the things that people are asking you at the town meetings and talks that you're giving and that kind of thing?
Well, to me, it's less the questions I'm being asked and more the things that I know are being heard, that people are more than ready to engage in a conversation that questions the status quo. People are ready, certainly in this district, and I personally believe around the country, to realize that asking the political status quo to solve our deepest problems is ridiculous, because the status quo is the deeper problem. The political status quo is what has brought us to this place. So the people of District 33 are not just lining up to toe the line with what the sort of political elite around here say is going to happen now. That's how it was presented to the people of this district after Henry Waxman's retirement was announced. And it was kind of like we were told. It was like the party would decide who we would have now. Right. And people just aren't interested. People aren't even angry. People just aren't interested anymore. People are open to new conversations. And an independent conversation such as mine, people know that I'm a Democrat. I've been a Democrat all my life, but that my allegiance is to my country more than to a political party. There are a lot of independents in this district. It's a trend in this country now. People are interested in hearing a candidate talk about what's really going down here. And that is that we are a legalized system of bribery and corruption. People nod their head. You ask me, what are people asking? They nod their head when you say we're a legalized system of bribery and corruption. People nod their head. You say, as long as multinational corporations have their own economic short-term gain taking precedence over the will of the American people, then, our democracy is being dismantled. People nod their heads. You talk about, let's not kid ourselves that we're going to adequately deal with climate change as long as the fossil fuel companies are dominating policies. Don't think we're going to adequately deal with GMOs or pesticides or herbicides as long as chemical companies and big biotech agricultural companies are dominating our policy. Don't think we're going to have universal health insurance as long as health insurance companies and pharmaceuticals are dominating our policies. People nod their head. People say, where can I sign up? Yeah. You talk to people about a constitutional amendment to outlaw the undue influence of money on our politics. People nod their head. You point out to people, why are we accepting incremental changes? In what area of your life do you ask for incremental changes rather than the whole enchilada? The whole enchilada is yours. This democracy was given to us. Why is it always such a fight? And that's what the excitement of this campaign is. Tom, people get it. People are, the political elite, the political status quo in this country really underestimates the American people. They don't seem to be getting the rumbling that's going on in this country. Americans are sometimes late to get it. But when we wake up, man, you're talking about a force on your hands. And that's what I feel this campaign is tapping into. That's why we are acknowledged by even the mainstream media now as a top-tier candidacy. That's why... that's why there's a lot of buzz here and a lot of energy, Tom, because this message, this is bigger than just one person's campaign. This is something that you and I and so many people, obviously Bernie Sanders and Alan Grayson and Keith Ellison and Dennis Kucinich and Lawrence Lessig and Robert Reich. I mean, there is a And David Corton, I mean, so many people have been contributing to this conversation, you know, really this Paul Revere energy. You know, it's not the British are coming, it's multinationals have come, and the billionaires. And there's a, we're democratizing the United States. I'm not a radical person. You've known me for a long time. I'm not a radical person. You're not a radical person. American democracy is a radical idea.
Yeah.
And every generation has not only a right to it, but a responsibility to foster it and to protect it. And I think what I'm getting in this district and in this campaign, Tom, is just a lot of nodded heads and people signing up for how they can help.
Yeah, that's a marvelous thing. And I, you know, one of the reasons I endorsed your candidacy way early on was I think that you are the next Bernie Sanders. Bernie, somebody who ran as an independent, who has had a dramatic influence on the Democratic Party, who has really gotten things done, and who has really transcended politics. I lived in Vermont for 10 years, and, you know, Louise and I used to drive around the northern part of the state, the Northeast Kingdom, the poor rural Republican part of Vermont, and in the in 2000 and 2004, and see in people's front yards, you know, where they're literally, I mean, they're living on $7,000 a year, sharpening change saws for a living, you know, and or part-time taxidermy. And there's a sign out in front for George Bush and a sign out in front for Bernie Sanders. They got it that, you know, Bernie tells the truth. And that's all they wanted to hear, is just somebody who tells the truth. And then in the cities, of course, you'd see, you know, Al Gore and Bernie Sanders. And it's just like, you know, truth tellers, radical truth tellers, for some reason, our political system is afraid of radical truth tellers. And Bernie is one and you are one. And I really honor that. And I think people are, you know, catching up to it. And so you are running as an independent, just for the record, so everybody gets this, that you're running as an independent, not as a Democrat. And we're talking with Marianne Williamson. MarianneForCongress.com is the website. And if you would like to talk with Marianne, if you have questions for a congressional candidate, I want to open this conversation up, see if we can do a bit of a national town hall meeting here. Have Danielle go through the callers that we've got on the board right now and ask if they would like to ask their question of you rather than me, and turn this into sort of like we do with, like we've done with Senator Sanders for 9 years now, I think, every Friday with our Brunch with Bernie segment, and take some listener calls. Marianne, what you talked about getting money out of politics. One of the things that I hear from Republicans as well as Democrats is that if they could just get the Supreme Court out of the way, they would vote immediately, just like they did with McCain-Feingold. It was bipartisan, to get money out of politics. It's just that they can't get around the Supreme Court.
I think it was you. You were the one who said to me, Tom, the words that the founders did not create the Supreme Court to lord over us.
That's right.
And that really impacted my thinking. The American people, the way our Constitution is written, there is always a way, there is always a power for the American people to have the final say if we exercise our powers. And even in this situation with the Supreme Court, there is a way for the American people to override these nefarious decisions, and that is through the passage of a constitutional amendment.
Yes.
And I don't think we shouldn't laugh at that. You know, of course it's difficult. It should be difficult. It shouldn't be easy to amend the Constitution. But that's what it took to abolish slavery, and that's what it took to give women the right to vote. And that is what it will take. Now, we all hope for a new constitution of the Supreme Court. But right now, and by constitution, I mean of the Supreme Court itself. But until we have that, we have to move ahead.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that the conversation around a constitutional amendment, it is worthy of our aspirations.
There you go. We're talking with Marianne Williamson for the hour, a candidate for the Congress in the 33rd District of California. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back, 15 minutes past the hour. Okay, welcome back. And Marianne, you're still here?
I am.
Okay, I took you off the board because for a few minutes there in that first segment, for about a minute and a half, you faded out like it was a bad cell phone call. And I thought that we were going to try and get a landline, but apparently
not.
Yeah,
I was hoping a landline too.
Okay.
Hoping for that. He's calling in from the landline right now.
Oh, he is right now. Okay.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah, okay. But we've got you on the line. So for this segment, let's just take a phone call here. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, watching Free Speech TV.
Okay,
Bob,
in the meantime, he's trying to call in right now.
Oh, okay. You want to hold on for a minute then?
Sure.
Hello?
Okay. Bob, hold on, Bob. And I'm going to put Marianne on hold too. And we're going to change phones here. And while we're doing this, I think we're going to change phone systems. And while we're doing this, I just want to get back to this this idea of the constitutional amendment. The 26th Amendment to the Constitution was proposed in March of 1971. The number one song on the hit parade around that time was Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction. It actually had come out 5 years earlier, but it was right at the top of the charts. And in that song, it had made this huge revival in 71. Was a line that said, "You're old enough to kill, but not for voting," or "You're old enough to die, but not for voting." From the time that the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age from 21 to 18, during the Vietnam War in 71, there was a national consensus that there was a crisis. From the time that hit the floor of the House and Senate until the time the three-quarter of the state had signed on to it and it had become an amendment to the Constitution was 3 months and 8 days. That's how fast it can happen when the American people get it, that there's a crisis. So now, Marianne, we have you on a landline?
You do, and I'm thrilled to know the fact that you just spelled out, because that's really wonderful information for me to have to counter those who say, yeah, but that'll take a long time.
Oh, no, the 26th Amendment, it was proposed on March 23rd, 71. It was ratified on July 1st, 71.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's what happens when people, people get it that there's a crisis, that there's a real crisis. I mean, the same thing arguably with ending prohibition. There have been a few others that were fast, some that were very slow, but yeah, that I think that's a great example.
Yeah, so. That really is, and I think that nobody, you cannot rationally predict or formulate a critical mass and a tipping point.
Yeah.
And I also think, I'm fascinated by the characterological aspect of the American mind, which leads us to stay asleep for a long time, and yet leads us to take powerful action very quickly once we do wake up.
Yeah.
And I think that that's happening here. A Japanese admiral famously said after Pearl Harbor, "I fear we have awakened a sleeping giant."
Yep.
I think the American people have been asleep, and it's been kind of like democracy's death by a thousand cuts. It's just a little bit of the National Defense Authorization Act over here, limitation of voting rights over there, Trans-Pacific Partnership over here, the fact that we can't deal with GMOs over there, the fact that we couldn't put single payer on the table over here, and it all adds up. And at some point, people go, "We have a problem here.
Yeah,
we have a pattern here."
Yeah, there's a cancer at the core of our democracy, and it's money. We will be right back with Marianne Williamson, candidate for the United States House of Representatives from the 33rd District of California, author of 10 books, lecturer and thought leader, MarianneForCongress.com, her website. Stick around. Back 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Marianne Williamson on the line with us. She is an independent running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 33rd District of California, more or less the Los Angeles area, and the seat that was occupied for many years, very ably, by Henry Waxman. And he is retiring, and this is going to be a really, really interesting race. And Marianne Williamson is one of the real, true, I've known, and just, I'll put this out there. I've known you for at least a decade and a half? I don't know how long. It seems like I've known you for a long, long time. And we are friends. And but that's not why I would do whatever I could for a friend. But I am behind you because I think you are one of the brightest, most committed, most insightful human beings that I've ever met or known in my life. And we so need people of your quality and caliber in politics, Marianne.
Well, thank you, Tom, and I feel the exact same way about you.
Thanks.
And this is an exciting time where so many of us can really feel we're collaborating in the same field of possibility.
There you go.
And you just,
that's part of what I think is giving us all of us hope right now, is the real sense that this is a symphony. You know, one of us playing the oboe, one of us playing the, you know, the piano, but a sense that one person's doing it on radio, one person's doing it, you know, in a nonprofit, another person's doing it in an online thing, so another person's doing it running for office. And it is just really getting that feeling of a genuine movement.
Yeah.
And I learn so much from you and always have, and so appreciate your support in this race, because your voice obviously means a lot to a lot of people, and particularly because, you know, part of the way that those who do not appreciate my message, or in a lot of cases just don't even want to hear what my message is because they want to keep, you know, keep things within that box of theirs, are those who are, you know, just positing that I'm a, you know, new age, silly person, guru, something. And so the support of people like yourself, whose gravitas is obvious, has really meant a lot to me. And
yeah.
you gave it to me early on, so I can't thank you enough.
There is nothing silly or fluffy about Marianne Williamson, let me tell you. And you're one of the most solid people I know. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, you're on the air with Marianne.
Yes, sir, Tom. I so appreciate your attitude, both of you. I feel lucky to be able to get in on your conversation. Appreciate you being on the air here with us. The point I'm going to make is relevant to an earlier part of the conversation about climate change, and I'm wondering about ending cannabis prohibition now. And if this really needs to be something that people have to wake up to, I think people have been awake to it for quite some time, and I would just hope that you could speak to this issue in more clear terms and get out there with it before you're elected, and I hope you are elected. You sound just great. And, you know, because Bernie won't talk about it. Nobody will talk about it once they're in
Bernie's,
the club.
Bernie has said he's all in favor of
industrial hemp. Yeah, but we need to air it out on TV. Why it's important to understand why it was made illegal in the first place.
Sure, yeah, and let's not relitigate that. Bob, thank you for the call. Marianne, your thoughts on decriminalizing hemp and or marijuana?
Well, I think we should decriminalize both.
I'm with you.
Yeah, and that all within the context of ending the drug war, period. We have 500,000 nonviolent drug offenders in the prisons of the United States today.
Yeah, and one of the points Bob makes, and he calls the program regularly about hemp, industrial hemp, is that it's a great way to convert sunlight into diesel fuel and things like
mm-hmm.
that. And it's
mm-hmm.
very, very efficient. Anyhow, Michael in Imperial Beach, California, you are on the air with Marianne Williamson. Michael? Michael is apparently not there. Okay. Let's try John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You are on the air with Marianne. John, can
you hear me? Yeah, I just wanted to make the quick point of the connection between morality and politics. And I think that's what people want to see. They want to see a good person be in a position of authority to help them. And they don't get that very much at all these days. We don't really have statesmen. We have people that support the status quo, grabbing for themselves. And I think that's the real turnoff in politics. And people who are politicians, they should realize the power of truth. Like Tom said, you know, they really respect somebody who will tell the truth at all costs, that have some ideals. And that's all that I wanted to say.
Thank you, John. Marianne, in fact, we had an interesting conversation yesterday. I had a long conversation with Phyllis Schlafly. And
on the air, Tom?
On the air, yeah.
Wow.
and we were talking about the Supreme Court, actually, and how Abraham Lincoln defied the Supreme Court, how he said that Article 3, Section 2 does not give the Supreme Court the power to change laws for everybody. He said when Dred Scott was passed, you know, that's tough luck for poor Mr. Scott, but it doesn't apply to everybody else, and I'm not going to enforce it. And he issued the Emancipation Proclamation and openly defied the Supreme Court. And Phyllis has written a book about this back a decade or more ago. It was a fascinating conversation. But what it came to was she was all about a completely different set of issues than me. You know, she wants to have abortion be criminalized. I think it should be decriminalized. You know, those kind of things, right? But what we were doing was separating issues from principles. and on the principles of how this country should work and how the Constitution works, there was an agreement, even though the issues was a disagreement. You're, in the minute we have left, your thoughts on that in general?
Well, traditionally, conservatives have emphasized issues of private morality, and liberals have emphasized issues of public morality.
Mm-hmm.
And over the last few decades, for reasons that I've never been able to figure out, the left has become so over-secularized, it's afraid of the M word. And so to me, moral issues do belong in politics. To me, economic justice is a moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
To me, preemptive war is a moral issue. The fact that we have the highest mass incarceration rate in the world is a moral issue. The fact that we have, among all advanced nations, the second highest child poverty rate is a moral issue. And your caller was absolutely correct. People are, like, particularly afraid to discuss these public issues in moral terms, and I think many Americans are hungry for it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Hold on just a second. We'll continue the conversation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're talking with Marianne Williamson for the hour, taking your calls at a national town hall meeting with Marianne. She's running for Congress in the 33rd District of California. MarianneForCongress.com. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Marianne Williamson is on the line with us. We're doing a national town hall meeting. I don't have a onomatopoeia for, you know, we have brunch with Bernie. What would it be? Marzipan with Marianne? Mingling with Marianne?
Marzipan with Marianne. Very funny.
I like marzipan. Okay. Marianne, welcome back. And
Thank you so much.
So glad to have you with us. We're taking calls. Marianne Williamson, of course, is running for Congress for Henry Waxman's old his old seat. His, you know, he's retiring. A good guy, distinguished legislator. Quite a legacy and a great seat for an independent candidate like Marianne Williamson to be in. And so, anyway, that's what's going on. MarianneForCongress.com is the website. Be sure to check it out. And Michael in Imperial Beach, California, you are on the air with Marianne.
How you doing, Mr. Hartman and Ms. Williamson? Ms. Williamson, Tom talked about in his first hour about these hedge fund managers making $2.1 billion in 1 year. As a fellow independent, if you are elected, is there any way to stop a single person from making $2.1 billion a year without rolling back the Reagan tax cuts? Thank you.
No, I don't think there. No, we should not be giving those tax cuts. Billionaires should not have their taxes cut. We should not be placing the U.S. government. The U.S. government should not be a cash cow for multi-billion-dollar empires and multinational corporate entities. This is all part of a pattern. It's not about one particular thing. It's not about one particular thing such as billionaires who are able to make that kind of money or whatever. Remember, we're not denigrating the fact that people can get rich in America. That's not the problem. The problem is that the economic injustice has become so systemic because of tax law, because of trade laws, because of banking laws, that too many people are falling into poverty every day through no fault of their own. So, of course, billionaires should be taxed in a fair way. And, of course, we have changed our tax policies over the last few years so that they're not. We have all been sold this bill of goods about trickle-down economics and giving more to the job creators. But I think we're at a psychological point in the development of evolution of our country and our view of things that most people know that. The issue now is not about waking people up to that. The issue now is about harnessing the fact that as many of us do understand it for political purposes. And so that's why, to me, there's not even a conversation to be had anymore. Of course it's unfair. Of course it's awful. Of course it's wrong. Of course it's undemocratic. You know, Louis Brandeis said you can concentrate large amounts of wealth in the hands of a very few, or you can have democracy. You cannot have both. We get this now. Enough Americans totally get that. And I think enough Americans totally get the urgency of this moment. The question now is, what will we do? Now, in my generation, we took to the streets. I think now we need to take to the halls of Congress. We need to develop more candidacies. You know, you look at someone like Bernie Sanders. We talk about Bernie Sanders all the time. The real issue is there should be more Bernie Sanders. And so that's why I feel so strongly that now the conversation has to turn to how are we going to create political heft? We've already been successful at the conversation, largely because of, obviously, Tom Hartman and others like him. Now we have to include in the formulation real political containers to create political heft and force behind these ideas. Because in a winner-take-all situation like we have, you know, there's no parliamentary system here. There's not going to be, certainly in our lifetime. So we have to get very serious now, I believe, in actually running campaigns based on this idea without it being just kind of an adjunct.
Sure.
You know, really being open and honest and radically truth-telling, as Tom was saying.
Okay.
And that's how I think, and it's the only way, I think,
we
will be able to end the situation.
We have callers for you from California, Florida, California, Illinois, New York, Oregon, Texas.
Okay,
and my
answer is shorter.
Okay. Jody in Venice, California. You are on the air with Marianne Williamson.
Jody? Hi, this is Jody.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say how glad I am to be able to vote for you, Marianne, this year. I'm so excited about your candidacy, and I think it represents the evolution of consciousness that is really the only thing that's going to change this country. And I'm really excited, and I wish the best to you.
Well, thank you so much, Jody. I'm so glad to hear you say that, and make sure you're totally on for the primary on June 3rd or absentee voting. Please come join us at the headquarters in Brentwood. Dennis Kucinich will be with us this coming Saturday morning down the street from you somewhere at the Source at 305 Rose. Dennis and Elizabeth Kucinich will be there, and we'll be canvassing and door-knocking, all of that. And I hope you'll put it on Facebook and Twitter and come help us and tell your friends and make sure everybody's registered and really collaborate with us to make it happen. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
There we go. Marcia in Englewood, Florida. You had a question for Marianne.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. Hi, Marianne. I really wish you the best, honestly. It scares me to death that you're running, though, as an independent, because you know what's happened so many times with independents.
Well, California has a slightly different system, Marcia. California has this top two, so
they have what?
They have a top two, so it's a complicated thing. But anyhow, back to your question for Marianne.
Anyway, my original question is, I don't understand with all the garbage that the Supreme Court five. We ought to give them a name. I don't know what though, but the Supreme Court five. have totally destroyed the Constitution. There has to be some lawyer somewhere in the United States that's willing to get these guys off the bench. We can't wait till they die. They're destroying the Constitution.
Well, what we can do is override their decisions, and that's not something to be left in the hands of the lawyers. That's something that's left in the hands of you and me, and that has to do with the constitutional amendment that Tom and I have been talking about. As far as independents, you say, oh, look what happened to them. Yeah, look what happened to Bernie Sanders. Look what happened to Angus King. I think sometimes, very often these days, the independents are the ones whose voices are of greater moral authority because they're not shackled by the party dogma. And as Tom was saying, in a system where you have an open primary, as we do in California, there's not a Democratic primary and then a Republican. There's just one primary, and the top two vote-getters on June 3rd then go to the general election in November. So I think it's a good time to be an independent, a real good time to be an independent. And in terms of what you were talking about with the Supreme Court, we just need to keep our eye on the ball, and that has to do with passing this constitutional amendment, buoyed by the information that Tom was giving us that in 1971, you said, Tom?
Yeah.
Changing the voting age.
Yeah, 3 months, 8 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking it could be done in a shorter time than 5 years, but now you've made me even speed up my time.
There you go, the 26th amendment. Yep. Larry in Santa Monica, California, you're on the air with Marianne.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, Marianne. Marianne, I'm a Democrat, and I generally tend to vote with the party. Like for you to give me some specific policy prescriptions that would differentiate you from Mr. Liu, who is, I know, who has been endorsed by the party. And the second part of that is, if we do send you to Congress, what would your top three priorities be?
Thank you so much for that, Larry. When it comes to actual policy positions, I think mine would be very similar to Ted Liu. That is not, there's not a huge wide difference in anything that I've read between myself and Ted Lieu. Ted Lieu would be a good congressperson, but he would be the status quo. He is entrenched within the system as it is. Whoever you get is going to be a first-term federal congressperson. So all of us will have to learn those particular ropes. The fact you've been a state legislator doesn't mean you know everything you need to know about being a federal legislator. But I believe, and he's a lovely man. Everybody I've met running in this for this office is a lovely man. But everybody else's conversation is basically a form of perpetuating the political status quo. My conversation is about disrupting the political status quo. I think we need a new conversation. I'm not just about going there and fighting. I mean, what, you know, somebody says they're going to go fight for you. They're going to fight the oil companies, really, while the Republicans are in power. Really, good luck with that. It's about making a stand, not just taking on a fight, but making a stand with a kind of motivation and a kind of inspiration that I believe is a unique qualification that I bring, including my capacity as someone who has a national audience that, if given the additional platform of U.S. congressperson, will enable me to help popularize these ideas even more around the country. Because what we need is 18 people speaking like this. And with all due respect, Mr. Lieu does not bring that. I bring that. And I've worked very up close and personal with people whose lives were in crisis for 30 years. And I feel I have an additional skill set having to do with what it really takes to transform crisis into opportunity. And it's not just external fixes. It's a deeper inquiry. So what Mr. Lieu would do, and any of the other candidates, they would work on the effects, but I would name the cause. They would work on the symptoms, but I feel we need to name the disease. And the traditional politicians working with the traditional political parties are not going to name the disease because that status quo is the disease. Both of those parties so beholden to that money, including the particular candidate you're talking about in terms of the corporate PAC monies and so forth. So when you ask about issues, that's one issue where we differ. I have announced I'm not publicly taking corporate PAC money, special interest lobby money, and all of that. So when it comes to many of the issues, I would vote the same as he, but it's an issue underlying the issues. That has to do with the money in politics. Has to do with taking a stand for that constitutional amendment and using my skills to magnify that voice both in Congress and outside of Congress so we really can do something to get that done. I feel I bring a passion and a robustness to that particular issue.
Marianne Williamson, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Marianne Williamson running for Congress in the 33rd District of California. MarianneForCongress.com, an opportunity to talk with an independent candidate. And welcome back. Jerry in Long Island, New York, listening to WBAI on Pacifica. Jerry, you're on the air with Marianne Williamson.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you, Marianne Williamson. And talking about upsetting the status quo, as you just were, my question has to do with the feasibility of us getting a single-payer Medicare for all-type health care system in this country. Because back on April 4th, Paul Krugman wrote a column saying that because of the power of the health insurance industry, therefore, the only way we could get health care reform in this decade is by running it through the private health insurance industry, which I disagree with. And before I ask you how you feel about it, I would point out that although a few people know this, and although it's probably unlikely that you could get Congress to extend Medicare to all Americans overnight, still nonetheless, I think you could do it incrementally, and you could do it gradually over time by lowering the age eligibility for Medicare more and more periodically, starting first with a drop in eligibility age to 55. And the thing I don't think many people know is that back in December of 2009, as an amendment to Obamacare, there was going to be a amendment that would have lowered the age of Medicare to 55, but it only got 59 votes instead of 60, and therefore failed to have enough votes to overcome a Republican filibuster of
the
measure.
Jerry, let's toss this to Marianne and get her thoughts on it. Thank you for the call. Marianne?
Hi, I think I'm on Skype and talking to you, is that right?
I'm not seeing the Skype.
You're not seeing the Skype.
Oh, it just connected. Well, if we can make it work, we will make it work. But,
okay, whatever.
But
we're doing fine.
Stay on the phone.
But I'm on your camera anyway.
Yeah, stay on the phone. But keep talking into the telephone. So okay. You heard Jerry's question? Could we say we're going to move everybody over to Medicare, drop every year the eligibility age by 10 years so that there's time for the bureaucracy to catch up and eventually have a single-payer system?
Do you think, well, Medicare for all, I'm open to any proposal that has to do with how we can get to universal. And using Medicare as a way to do it, just Medicare for all, certainly seems to me like a proposal very well worth looking at. As long as we have the national intention to make it universal, I'm open to a variety of ways that that could possibly happen. Making it Medicare for all, making it lowering the age is certainly one way it could happen, and that to me is a worthy way. So I'd certainly be willing to take the stand for that if that was the way we could make it happen.
Yeah. In fact, I think Dennis proposed that some years ago. He called it Medicare Part E, and
I
borrowed
that. Well, it's a system that works, so
yeah. Why not? Yeah. I mean, the whole system is there. We have just a minute before we hit the next break, and that's not really enough time to give a caller, good benefit. One of the things that Bernie has pointed out is that one of the cool things about, and by the way, we have your picture now on TV. One of the things that Bernie has pointed out, or I mean your video, is that Vermont is that one of the cool things about Obamacare is that it provides states with the opportunity to do single payer, and Vermont is doing that. And he thinks that we're going to go the Canada route, that like Saskatchewan was the first. And then everybody else said, hey, I want that. Mm-hmm. And that Vermont's going to be the first, and then everybody's going to say, I want that. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think sometimes we say the devil's in the details, and we get all involved in the details. Are we going to do it Medicare for all? Are we going to do single payer as the Canadians do and so forth? To me, the devil's in the big picture. And so, like I said, I'm open. I'm open to a Canadian-style single payer. I'm open to Medicare for all. I think the main point is to get to the point where we realize that the American people want universal. We want universal coverage. And sometimes we leave out of the formula how important it is to get that national consensus. Once we get that national consensus, how we do it.
Welcome back, John Harmon here with you. Final 10 minutes of the show today. And Richard in Lebanon, Missouri, you are on the air with Mary Ann Williams.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Richard.
Hey, I just watched a deal on C-SPAN today where the Democrats got out front on the Capitol steps with a long-term unemployed in the country. And I was wondering if Mary Ann Williamson would stand with them out there on the steps of the Capitol after the Republicans refused them a room inside.
Absolutely, I would stand on the steps of the Capitol. I think there are times when theater like that is very important, but I would do more than that. And that's I would also face the ways that even that party, not all the members, of course, but too many times it's the political dogma of either party to increase to actually expand the factors that make all that unemployment inevitable. So, yeah, I would be standing on the steps of the Capitol, but the place where I would really be kicking some ass is inside the Capitol, which I think is even more important.
There you go. Ed, in Fayetteville, Arkansas, you're on the air with Mary Ann Williamson.
Yes, thank you. Mary Ann, I've read your for a long time and love you. I would like to know the latest religious freedom laws that they are passing in various states. That are targeted for LGBTQ people, but would impact, I believe, a larger swath of our community. Where do you stand on those type of laws?
Oh, I think it's absolutely absurd, and obviously they are being used in the most cynical ways, saying that someone, because of their religious freedom, could leave a gay person, could deny service to a gay person, and so forth. Obviously, that's a canard. We have religious freedom in this country. That's not that we don't have a problem with that. So anytime you see somebody saying that they are using a religious freedom law at this time, usually it's a cover. It's a cover for homophobic activity or whatever. So you can be sure that I would not only resist it in every way, but I would be vocal about doing so.
Okay. Charlie in Hermiston, Oregon. You're on the air with Mary Ann Williams.
Well, hello to the both of you. Mary Ann, I don't know anything about you. I understand you're independent, and there's time coming when they will reach Congress, and I hope it's soon for you. I'm asking about your opinion of the veterans in the recent light of the scandal that's going on in Phoenix and what's happened in the past. If and when you do reach Congress, would you remember us, please?
You said
we'd like
veterans,
to help you
right,
get
sir?
There.
You said veterans, correct?
Yes.
We have 10,000 homeless veterans in the Los Angeles area alone. We have, as I'm sure you know, you realize, sir, about one an hour of our military veterans commit suicide. We have an extraordinary issue here, an extraordinarily dangerous one. First of all, I promise you from the depth of my heart that I would vote against the Military Authorization Act, which gives the president year after year the opportunity to send our military people wherever he wants them to go, whenever he wants them to go, under the vague rubric of fighting terrorism. So that's the first thing I would take a stand for, is far greater sobriety in our decision-making about where our troops go to begin with. Secondly, in terms of the veterans, the people who have gotten home, we are very definitely, I think we use our rah-rah, we love them, we support the troops, sloganeering as a cover for the way we underserve them once they do get back. Both in terms of education, you know, some of the educational opportunities that are available to our veterans, it's almost hard for them to get the information. There are all kinds of things, both in terms of mental health services, but also in terms of the services such as those proposed by people like Tim Ryan that have to do with meditation and so forth. I think there are so many people in this country who would be so glad to be of service to our military veterans, but we don't have an infrastructure. We don't have an infrastructure whereby the average citizens could and would, if they were given the opportunity to, serve our veterans when they are coming home, both in terms of incentives for people hiring them. A lot of times veterans don't want to have post-traumatic stress disorder on their resume, because then it would make it less likely. So I think that there's much more we could do to not only be of service to these people in terms of the damage to their souls and to their bodies that they are dealing with, but also in terms of paving the way for them to have a greater opportunity to actually move back into life in a way that is robust, that is abundant, that is creative, and which gives them their due. And when that is our national intention, when that is what our Congress people stand for, as opposed to this silly support the troops business, then I think that we will be supporting the veterans in the way they deserve to be supported, including here in my district and the veterans buildings that we have.
We have just 1 minute left, Marianne. Some of the questions that are still on the board, what do we do about the media? Do you support the Disclose Act? Do you really think you could change the Constitution, et cetera? But let me give that last minute to you to say whatever you think is important to wrap up for the week.
First of all, can you change the Constitution? What do you think amendments are? Amendments are, you know, the Constitution is a living, breathing document. You know, we're not changing the Bill of Rights. We're not changing the basic construct, nor do we want to. But the fact that the Constitution allows for us to amend it is part of the genius of our Constitution. It's part of what allows it to breathe. It's part of what allows every generation to do our thing in our time, to meet the challenges of our time. We have as you've said, Tom, we have a cancer eating our democracy. We have a legalized system of bribery and corruption, and it's time for the American people to step in. This two-party duopoly is a chokehold on our system. It's sucking the oxygen out of our public discourse. It's time for a people's movement, for people's intervention, for a people's pattern interruption. And I dedicate my campaign to that, and if elected, I will dedicate 2 years of my life, and I promise you I would slam it to the best of my ability.
You absolutely will. Marianne Williamson, MarianneForCongress.com is the website. Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Great having you with us today. That's it for the show for today. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. And, Marianne, good grief. I mean, talk about getting involved. She's running for Congress. The very least we can do, right, is show up, participate with our local organizations. Get out there, get active, tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.